Today is Wednesday. It's 2:36 in the afternoon on January 26th, 2022. Hi, it's John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. Thanks for finding us. Share us with your friends. Give us a good rating. And listen for me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Hey, it's John Hanson from Block Club Chicago and host of Let's Get Legal and Your Money Matters on WGN.
This is Brandon Pope with WCIU CW26.
Lisa Donovan. I'm with the Chicago Tribune. I edit and write about business now.
I'm Eric Zorn, the warm and toasty editor and writer for the Picayune Sentinel and occasional columnist in the Daily Herald.
You're not one of those people that sends pictures of you on a golf course in Arizona to all their friends in Chicago, are you, Eric?
No, I would be if I were on a golf course in Arizona, but I'm sequestered here in my house. It really makes me realize, though, the privilege of being able to stay inside on a day like this. It's not something I take for granted. So,
have you seen your heating bill lately? Holy cow. Mine was a car payment. The one we got for December at the 1st of January, I don't know what the January bill is going to be, but I'm thinking my heating bill is probably going to be around $50,000 for this month.
But John, you live in a mansion.
Yeah. I mean, close some of the doors in that 19-bedroom house you have.
Maybe time to downsize.
Hey, look, I don't want to hear about it.
Why?
Because I just combined Ottawa with that. So I just tried to do something clever. It didn't work out that
way. I don't want to hear about it. Oh, good. Yeah. That's a reference to Ottawa, where I've got my mansion.
Yes.
Last we heard from Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, he was not attending in-person court hearings because Justice Neil Gorsuch wouldn't wear a mask when they were all together. Sonia Sotomayor and Justice Gorsuch both suggested that the reporting on that wasn't entirely accurate. But be that as it may, we now hear that after more than two decades on the Supreme Court, Justice Breyer is stepping down. At the end of this term, he says he'll retire, though he also says he'll stay on until a replacement is named and confirmed. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said today, Democrats now have the power to replace Justice Breyer in 2022 without one Republican vote in support. Elections have consequences, Graham said.
Oh, that's just a passive-aggressive remark from Lindsey, trying to remind the Democrats they shouldn't be complaining about the way the last two justices got placed onto the court. I'm glad that Breyer retired. I know that this has been something that progressives, liberals, and Democrats have been really itching for because they fear, I think with some merit, that the Democrats are going to lose control of the Senate, so that if Breyer were to retire, say, next year, then getting a confirmation through the Senate for justice with any progressive bona fides at all would be very difficult. So now Biden has a chance. The talk is that he's going to appoint an African-American woman, which he has promised to do. And I have adopted the same posture with this that I do with the Bears coaching search, which is I don't want to hear about the candidates. I want to hear who the nominee is. I'm not going to fill my brain with the resumes of judges from across the country when I have no input into this decision at all.
That's interesting because I heard one of the nominees is going to be Ryan Pace, so you might want to pay a little attention to that. Joe Biden did say on the campaign trail once upon a time, given the chance he'd nominate a black woman. So there are a lot of questions about that, like what happens if that woman is the current vice president?
No, they've already
tamped that out.
Yes, and he just said in a press conference that she will be the nominee for vice president with him in 2024. It's a huge day, though, if you're anywhere on the left. What a big day to celebrate, knowing that you can solidify your 6-3 minority on the Supreme Court without having to worry about a 7-2 court, perhaps, one day. And he will appoint a black woman, and it's about darn time. Yeah. Never had a black woman on the Supreme Court. Black women make up a huge part of our population. The Supreme Court should look and feel like the nation that they represent and rule over with their laws, and long overdue. It's going to happen. And I don't know whether it'll be 50-50 or it'll be 453-47, but it won't matter. It'll get done.
Yeah, the Kamala Harris thing just felt like weird SCOTUS fan fiction that people were trying to write. It doesn't make any logical sense, but it's a disservice to all the outstanding black women men out there who have really risen up the ranks in the legal circle and would be outstanding candidates for the Supreme Court. There's so many out there right now. You got Michelle Fields in South Carolina. I believe the woman that leads the California Supreme Court, she's a black woman. Marilyn Mosby in Baltimore, she obviously rose to prominence when she was dealing with a lot of police violence cases. You even got like
Ketanji Brown Jackson, who's on the
Ketanji Brown Jackson.
She seems to be sort of the front runner, at least in media circles.
Lindsey Graham already voted for her in the 11th Circuit.
Right.
So there you go.
No, that's exactly right. She's been vetted. She was just nominated for the Circuit Court, the Federal Circuit Court in D.C., in July? Mm-hmm. And you know, passed through a Senate vote of 53-44. She's young. So that's something that the Democrats want to see, somebody who's going to be in there for a long time. I think she's 50 or 51. So, you know,
Biden's going to pick her up at the airport.
Somebody put a video of them rolling through.
Can we wear a Bears jacket while he does it?
Why not? Why not?
I imagine that 51 doesn't sound very young to Brandon, who just turned 30. Am I right, Brandon? Like
just turned 30. Yeah, but it's still spry. 51 is spry.
And we don't fear, there's no concern that a couple of renegade senators will do to this nomination what they've done to some of the other big bills.
I was going
to
mention that.
Oh,
yeah.
No chance in heck.
Really?
No chance. Manchin and Sinema have been along with every judicial nominee that's happened so far under President Biden. We're talking dozens of them. They will be there when this happens. No matter what. You think they're going to step out of line and be someone to reject?
Well, they have before. But you know, one thing
they've done on everything else.
Well, that's my point.
Nominees.
You know, one thing you didn't say, though, when you said it's about time, John Hansen, is it's about time that a person with the qualifications.
Of course,
John, I know that, but I think that that's not a small part of the conversation. What's the matter?
People always have already chirping on me at Twitter saying, no, you pick the most qualified people. Of course you're going to pick qualified people. They're not going to go to Costco and look for the first black women they found. There are dozens and hundreds and thousands of qualified black women who could be on the United States
Supreme
Court. Okay,
but what people I think see is sort of this pyramid, and on the top is the qualified person, is the best quarterback, and that's the one you want, and you don't want people along the way. You want to get the best person. Well, what if that person was not a black or a female? Then what do you do?
And Steve Harvey.
Say that
Steve
again.
Steve Harvey. Doesn't he have a judge show now?
Okay. And I appreciate the folly of my question because there is no perfect candidate. There is no top of the pyramid. There's a bunch of people right there that essentially are the same. It's always going to be a subjective call. But the call that the gender and race of the person comes before the qualification, the way you put it, John, just rubs people the wrong way sometimes.
Fine. I didn't say before the qualification. I meant in adjacent to being super qualified to hold that position. And it does matter. You should be choosing people that represent what the country looks like. And along with that comes that qualification. Yes.
We're having a little bit of a discussion that's going to be mirrored in the Supreme Court's consideration of affirmative action, which is coming up, I believe, next term. They're going to hear arguments on that. But when we're talking about the value, you talk about qualifications. I think I would side with at least John and probably maybe the rest of you on the panel, which is that being a black woman and having that experience and being able to represent that experience on the Supreme Court is a qualification. And so I think it's important on its own level for that. So you're right. You don't want to go and just grab someone off the street, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about there are a raft of qualified people to be on the Supreme Court and a raft of qualified African-American women to be on the Supreme Court.
Right. And the other
I'll look
side
forward to learning
we,
about one
the
of
other
them.
Side of it is that we've long only put white men on there. What makes them more qualified? I mean, you come back to that criticism, Mr. Williams. You know, what makes a white male more qualified?
I'm not saying it's been a good thing the way we've done it in the past. I'm just saying any more than you like, let's make sure we get a white guy. I mean, that's stupid. Let's not make sure we get a black female. Let's make sure we get a person with the qualifications. I just wanted
that.
But
I guess the assumption here is that I think we're moving beyond that. The assumption is that it's going to be somebody who's very qualified.
He has no choice, though. Biden has to elect a black woman because he said he was going to.
He said, yeah.
And he's in a place right now politically. He can't afford to not do that after all the stuff he's been going through.
Well, and I wonder where senators like Mitt Romney, Lisa Murkowski, some of these more moderate Republicans, it's going to be a really bad look for them if they seem to be just churlishly opposing whoever Biden puts up there, even if it's a qualified, especially if it's a qualified African-American woman. You're just going to be voting for them out of pure partisan, voting against them out of pure partisan spite.
Well, Democrats did do that under Trump, nearly pure partisan spite. Only Manchin voted for Kavanaugh, and only a few of them voted for Gorsuch, and some of them were in tough races. So, no, I would expect Republicans.
But those were different circumstances, too. Well, there was some extenuating.
And Kavanaugh was a liar, too. Kavanaugh got up in front of that panel, and then he lied. I don't care. I actually didn't care that much about what he had done in high school, but his lies about all the stuff back in high school, he wanted to deny all that stuff. That was shameful. I think he perjured himself.
I think we got a handful of Republicans, but we're not looking at some 60-40 vote coming up. There's a couple retiring Republican senators that might see the light on this nominee, perhaps. And we'll have to wait and see who it is, of course, to determine their ideological spectrum, how the hearings go, what comes out. I mean, this is a long process. This is not going to be done by February or March. This is something that happens throughout the spring and summer.
Unless it's Amy Coney Barrett, which means they can do it in like 2 weeks.
And the court, it's inherently political now. I mean, it's supposed to be this apolitical thing and, oh, we're higher than that and we're above that. But it's become super partisan. So at this point, I had expected to go along party lines, no doubt.
Do you think he's responding in a way to how Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat was handled and how that decision was made, John?
This exact same thing happened in 2014, the spring of 2014, Obama's second term. Before the midterms, the writing was on the wall that the Republican Senate would hold and not take any, would maybe perhaps not nominate another Supreme Court justice if it came down to a death, which absolutely happened with Scalia in February of 2016. They approached Ruth Bader Ginsburg and tried to nudge her into retirement. She didn't. I imagine that as the first term of President Trump wore on and her age wore on, it's something she may have ultimately regretted. I don't know. But it's certainly something that Democrats wish would have happened 5 years previous.
Well, he's definitely been on sort of the interview circuit. I wondered if something was looming. In the fall, you saw him sitting down with 60 Minutes and kind of doing these sort of, I don't want to be morbid, but sort of these kind of obit type interviews, like this is my life on the court. It just seems strange that he was suddenly sort of on the circuit. So I wondered if something was looming. So to me, this didn't come as a huge surprise.
Yeah, when he appeared on The Masked Singer, I knew something was up. He took off the panda bear head and it was Stephen Bryan. Wow. Game over. That's how I knew.
Y'all got jokes today. I love it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, if you don't laugh, you cry.
John Highbrow with that TV watching.
Oh, well.
Hey, that's my mom's favorite show, allegedly. So,
hey, speaking of Joe Biden, and we are a little bit here, Fox News White House correspondent Peter Doocy called out a question to President Biden. He said, do you think inflation is a political liability in the midterms? Says the New York Times, Mr. Biden's patience was low and the volume was up.
What do you think, President Biden, inflation? Thank you. Thank you. Do you think inflation is a political liability?
That's a great asset. More inflation. What a stupid son of a...
In a month of hot mic gaffes, Biden should have been more careful. Maybe that was not such a hot mic gaffe after all. Do you think it's possible that he thought, good, it's about time I spoke power to truth or truth to power or whatever. I'll give them what they got coming.
Yeah, I think he probably knew it was on and he didn't care. It objectively, it is a dumb question. Come on. Inflation is a liability? Come on. Even with Trump, I find his questions to be stupid. And it's sort of like, let's give somebody else a chance that's actually going to ask a smart question.
Right. I mean, but Joe Biden is not good at this. His press conference wasn't that good, and he's just not good at this.
No.
I mean, what's the operative word in that question? It's inflation. So forget about is it good or bad. Just talk about inflation and say how we're going to try and keep it down. You must have a boilerplate answer for that. But Brandon, he can't help himself sometimes. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and you can kind of see some frustration coming out. Honestly, I don't think voters are reacting well to these moments of frustration or flippantness that the White House gives sometimes. We've seen Jen Psaki say some things recently where it's just very flippant and kind of inconsiderate. This is not good. I don't think it's a good thing to, you know, assail insults at the press, you know?
What?
It's funny.
It worked for the last president. I mean, seriously.
That's the thing. It worked for the last president, and he did it a lot.
So. I saw people on Twitter saying, I don't agree with a single thing Joe Biden's ever said, but this was hilarious. I liked it. I loved when Trump, I didn't like when he said, when he challenged the rights of the press to be there or called them the enemy of the people. But when someone would ask Donald Trump a dumb question and he would be flipping, it was my favorite part of the Trump presidency. And I think Biden had a better press conference than you guys think, except on all matters Ukraine, which I guess was probably the most important part of the press conference. Mm-hmm. But he was flipping about the Newsmax question that he answered as well, and a couple others. And I actually think that Joe Biden should do a lot more of that. Be a human being. People like that in people, and will respond to that.
He should. But on the other hand, there is this part of his brand, which is the empathy thing, which is he's the one who cares about you, so that when you ask about inflation, he needs to, instead of realizing what the deuce he's just trying to get a response, get a rise out of him, that he needs to turn back to empathy, to understanding what people are going through, to at least expressing a determination to try to do something about it. It's very difficult, of course, for a president.
Boy, that's,
to
fix
it. Boy, that's no, a really no, bad no. answer, Eric.
He's not asking this. First of all, the reporter is not asking sort of like, what do you say to people who are like trying to decide between whether to feed their families or skip a meal? No, he's asking if it's a political liability on the campaign.
That's why he asked an insensitive question. But that's why he has to. The president has to pivot. Needs to do what all politicians do, which is like answer the question you wish he'd asked. Right?
Yeah. What have we learned over the last 5 years? That the politicians that don't act like politicians are more popular. That people that act like average people, that respond to human beings like normal people respond, are more favorable. What has empathy? And by the way, this is not a situation where Joe Biden's comforting someone who lost someone or is going through something. This is a reporter. What has empathy gotten him in that situation? A 38% approval rating? Be a normal guy, react like normal people do, and people will like you a lot more. It's the one big lesson from Donald Trump that every politician should learn.
What's the empathetic response to that, Eric? Why don't you go ahead and be Joe Biden here, and I'll be Peter Ducey. Hey, Eric, do you think that inflation is a good thing?
He was saying, is it a political liability?
I
would say, well, that's a dumb question, because of course it's a political liability, but here's what I'm going to do about it.
Who likes that answer better? Raise your hand.
I actually do. I'm with Eric on this. Like, Joe Biden's whole brand is civility and, oh, I'm the nice guy. You can't use the same playbook as the predecessor you had before.
But he is. They've retooled the messaging, and you heard him come out even not this last press conference, but he was taking questions and he was sort of kind of digging at the press a little bit. And I thought, okay, here we go.
Yeah,
I think he was genuinely ticked off. But he did throw out a few criticisms of the media. And I don't think it was the last one, but he said something. Do you like your job? Do you think you're good at your job, to a reporter? It's sort of that sort of needling where I'm like, OK, is this what we can expect? No, these guys all borrow off of each other. You've seen it with everybody. You've seen it with Democrats and Republicans.
Can we at least delineate that there's a big difference between being off the mic, or, you know, like a casual hot mic comment about how dumb a reporter's question is, versus challenging what the press represents and that they are a danger to people? So when we're saying he's taking something, or when people suggest he's taking a little bit from Trump, he's not taking that horrific line of talking. He's taking the casualness.
I understand that. But in light of what Trump has done, I understand that any kind of poke is more of a pounding.
I wonder if he would have said that if it was a CBS or New York Times reporter, as opposed to.
It wasn't a hot mic moment either. He had the mic on and the question was shouted from
him. He knew
the mic was on. So I don't believe that it was a hot mic moment.
All I'm saying is, I think there is no more sensitive, oversensitive people that are so self-aggrandizing than TV reporters across the board. And they get so, and to Ducey's
Brandon.
Yes, you would know. You would know.
Ducey made a joke about Ducey it. I thought it was funny.
He handled it really well.
Yeah, the next
and that
day.
Was great.
You know, Barack Obama couldn't get away with that.
Get away with
But Joe Biden did when he was vice president. So
he sure did. That's true.
I am persuaded a little bit by what John is saying, though, that that's a natural human response. And it sure seemed to be almost appropriate when Barack Obama was signing the Affordable Care Act. I mean, you could imagine him saying that. That seemed authentic.
That's
you know?
Joe.
But I think the problem with his approval rating is that, and I don't want to spend much time on assessing his presidency based on his approval rating, because it's just the first year and things are in flux, and I don't know how important that is right now.
Well, it's like the midterms.
Exactly, Lisa. It's the midterms. It's his approval rating doesn't matter. He's not up for election for another 3 years. But the Congress
people don't like him. They'll vote this year.
The House is, I think most people think, a lost cause. It'll still be tough in the Senate for the Democrats to hold, but it's an easier pathway.
In sports, after a thrilling weekend of NFL playoff football, Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers are gone, and the world is reminded that the overtime rules in the league are, how shall we put it, wrong. If a team scores a touchdown on its first possession in overtime, the other team doesn't get a turn. The game is over. You sort of knew this about the NFL, but when quarterbacks were having such a great time giving us thrilling football, to deny one of the teams a chance to even the score just seems so simply, patently wrong.
I think the purest overtime in all of sports is college football overtime. In college football overtime, both teams get a possession. And if they keep going, then hey, you got to start doing two-point conversions. And you get these great moments. In pro football, it's the only pro sport whose overtime doesn't allow the other team to get a chance at it. What kind of overtime is that?
Technically, hockey, right? If you win the faceoff and score, the other team wouldn't get to touch the puck, right? I mean, is that?
Yeah, that could happen. Yeah, sure. I mean,
it probably never has, but it could happen.
Possession is a lot more tenuous in hockey.
I reject the notion of your sports savants that you're talking to. I hate the NFL's overtime policy I think that Brandon is exactly right that the college football has it figured out, that you give each team a chance with the ball and you keep changing the parameters of it so that it doesn't go on for absolutely ever. Although I think U of I and Penn State played nine overtimes or seven. Nine. Eight
was that seven. Was wild. That was an anomaly.
No one wants to see that.
But you wouldn't, because of that, change the rule in college football or anything else, would you?
No, I actually don't like the college overtime rules. I think it's silly to put one at the 25-yard line. Yeah. I mean, you're working with a quarter of the field. Maybe we can work out something where each team gets it at the 50. Maybe that would help change things a little bit.
If only we had a sports expert with us to talk about this.
John Greenberg is the lead columnist for The Athletic's Chicago coverage and The Athletic's founding editor, and he has some wisdom to lay on us about the NFL overtime rule, which so far all the voices that have chimed in, John, don't like it.
Yeah, it could be better. I mean, I think anyone could say it obviously could be improved with both, you know, both teams getting a possession. It's actually, it is improved, though, because it used to be whoever wins the coin flip could win it on a field goal. But I wasn't like as angry about it as other people. I don't know. Games have to end. Like, I mean, you know, that's kind of how I feel about it at the end. You know, I mean, Buffalo shouldn't, like, Kansas City shouldn't have even tied it in regulation. That's the real crime, was them letting Kansas City tie the game at the end there. So,
right. There wasn't like a no chance for Buffalo to win. There were many chances for them to win.
But they say this all of the time. They say, well, then play better defense and the other team won't have a chance to tie the score and lose the coin toss. But it's a full game. One team had a good first half. The other team had a better second half. And so at the end of the day, however they got there, the score is tied. The teams are even.
They could improve the rule by doing a possession. Obviously, then you get to the point where how long is the game going to take? Eventually, you're going to have to, you know, fiddle with the rules a little bit, like colleges do. You know, after, you know, two overtimes, then you go to, you had to score a touchdown. You had to go for two. You know, you're eventually going to start fiddling with the rules so much. Like colleges now, you have to go there, like, dueling two-point conversions after, like, you know, two overtimes. I hate that. Stinks. That's like, that's not like sports. That's like,
I love it. Agreed. It's so silly. John, what do you think about, like, a 10-minute period so it's timed, just like anything else, and then with 10 minutes, each team's most likely going to get a possession, and you have the element of the time pressure still.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be fine with that. Now, I know, obviously, NFL players, like, I don't think most of them want to play anymore after four quarters. I don't think there's a lot of NFL players at the end of the game are like, you know what I need is more football.
more head collisions.
Right. I want more trauma in my body.
I mean, I think it would have been great on Sunday if then the Chiefs, after they scored their touchdown, had to kick off to the Bills. And if the Bills didn't score a touchdown, then they were done. And then they could have gone back and forth full field football.
I think that game was so, like, you know, it's so crystallizing because these teams are really fun to watch.
Oh,
like,
my God, what a game.
Does anyone want to watch more Bears football?
You know, when they did anyone here on the panel have a strong rooting interest in that game? Like, you really, really cared who won?
Because I was going for Bills.
I was rooting for them, but I was enjoying the game so much. I mean, it's like I was almost laughing during it. It was so much fun, and I was thinking, like, if you really were rooting for one team or another, it would have been such an emotional roller coaster that I don't know if you could have even enjoyed it.
And you know what we were talking about with my friends on gambling about it? Like, yeah. I have a friend from Ohio who's, it's not legal yet, so it's legal here. So I'll place, I'm like his bookie. I'll place, like, legal, you know, bets for him online. And we were talking about, we're like, we can't pick a winner for this game. I don't see, there's no advantage. And we were right? Because there's no, like, you're like, this game is totally even. There's no point betting on it because, like, how am I supposed to know who's going to win? Now, we might have had money on the over. The game was so evenly matched, it was like, it made perfect sense. It was basically a pick-em.
When you see these great offenses going at it, right? We've seen eras of great quarterbacks before. Tom Brady, Peyton Manning. But never to this level where the offenses are just so absorbently outstanding. With the NFL, could they possibly, is there any way they take that into consideration with the change in rules that favor offenses now and that explosion of these talented quarterbacks, that a rule change just might have to be an adaptation with the times?
I think so. I think that's a great point. You know, the fact that it used to be tough for teams to kind of march down the field and even get a field goal. And the fact that now, like, it takes 13 seconds for Patrick Mahomes to score a touchdown. Like, when they went to overtime, and it is a good point, you make a great point, because is there anyone who thought the Chiefs weren't going to score a touchdown? Like, on that
13 seconds, got all the time in the world.
Right, it would have to, but I'm saying even in overtime, like, when they won the coin toss, everyone's just like, okay, it's over. Like, not like, okay, this is going to be fun to watch. Everyone's just like, no, they're going to score, like, right now.
Right, but is a missed part of this conversation that the defenses, I applaud the offense, the quarterbacks were so much fun to watch, but was the world questioning some of the decisions that the coaches were making on some of these plays? Like, when a team has timeouts, they can run right up the middle of the field and then call a timeout. They were defending the out of bounds, but shoot, it worked if you just passed up the middle. When you kick off with a little time left, keep it on the ground and burn a couple of seconds.
And you can get burned by that too. Like, I understand, like, the risk. These coaches are so risk averse, so much on the line. So, like, I can understand their thinking some ways, because there's other ways, you know, they're thinking about every way that can go wrong instead of sometimes, like, what can go right. So, yeah, they didn't call great defense. Everyone was saying Leslie Frazier should have been, like, a hot Bears candidate, but, like, how can you be a head coach candidate after that meltdown? That's just like, there goes his job.
Especially when you have the number one ranked defense in the NFL. Didn't look like it by any means.
But, you know, one last thing about the overtime rules in the NFL. It's interesting to think of how hockey does it, where that game, it becomes a completely different game at the end of a hockey game. It would be the equivalent of one of those kick, punt, pass competitions they had for kids. Now we're going to do 4-on-4. Now we're going to do, can you score on the goalie? It becomes a skills competition, you know?
But not in the playoffs.
And I understand it for the NHL. They're trying to juice interest and...
What do you make of the treatment that Aaron Rodgers got after the Packers' loss? Was that delicious? Did the whole world enjoy that, or was that just Chicago?
No, I think everyone did. And, like, you know, he's whining now about people are mad at him about COVID, you know, his vaccination stuff. You know what it is? It's not – that's part of it for sure, 100%. Some people, like, especially people that aren't really into sports, you know, are obviously doing that. I think it's more because he's so pompous about it, and he won't shut up about it. You know, like, he just gave 28 minutes to an ESPN reporter right before. I don't know if it was that week or the week before. And I used to like Aaron Rodgers.
I did, too.
I mean, he's just, like, turned into a whiny, pompous guy now.
He used to be really likable because he's super talented. I used to be on the same
boat. His turn. You never knew who that guy was until he finally got his turn. And then, damn, he was even better. You got to admire his craft. We've seen enough of it in Chicago.
And I never had a problem with that. I just liked watching him play. Now it's like – you know what? When you're that pompous about something, people are going to, yeah, people are going to have, there's going to be, you know, what is it, Schadenfreude? Is that how you pronounce it? I can never pronounce it right.
Yeah. I saw you wrote that, and then I thought, oh, wait, I know that word. How does it go again?
Exactly. It's one of those things you write, but you can't, I'm like a late Seinfeld where I can never pronounce things. Of course, people are going to be like that. So, like, tough luck, buddy. You people are zinging you on Twitter. Deal with it. You're Aaron Rodgers. You go on the Pat McAfee show for no reason other than to talk, and people get mad at stuff he says. Well, then, you know what? Deal with it, man. And I thought it was hilarious, and I was happy that Bears fans, you know, got to celebrate their little, like, mini Super Bowl.
Yeah, that was our win. One last thing before we let you go, Jonathan, and that is, do you have an opinion about robot umpires in baseball? We'll see it at the AAA level this year. Is that going to be good for the game?
Well, I mean, you know, shout out to my guy, Les Grobstein. He hated the idea of robot umps. You know what? I don't like the idea of it. You know, I'm always fine with an idea that there's an appeal process. You can get a little aid. Like if an umpire has a question, maybe he could go to it and say, well, was that? I didn't see it. That makes perfect sense because pitchers are throwing harder than ever. They throw nastier breaking stuff. Can't expect an ump to see everything. I would be fine with some kind of appeal process like that, like an instant one using a computer, not like huddling for every ball and strike. But you know what? That's the system is not as perfect as people think. And that's the big problem. I think it's going to cause more headaches if it went to full automation. I know a guy, Josh Vitters. He was a Cubs draft pick, you guys might remember. Mm-hmm. And I talked to him last year, and he's playing in the Atlantic League, and he said it was a mess. The whole stuff they were doing was just a disaster. And you know what? I like a little ump show. I know people don't. I like an ump show. I mean, what are we doing here? We're just watching a baseball game.
Baseball does have room for more of that because there's 162 games. So it's not like a bad ball strike call is going to tip a season. You ought to be able to make up a bad call here or there. Eric, do you have anything to say about all of this?
I do. Well, as you know, John, I am all in favor of accuracy in sports. And this published estimates that I've read have about a 4.1% error rate on ball strike calls from major league umpires. That's just too high.
Hey, good. What are you talking about?
No,
I was an umpire for 14 years, and if you tell me I was going to get 95% of the calls right, I'd be thrilled. You know how hard it is?
No, I'm not saying that they're bad at their. Most of them are good at what they do, but that's a pretty high error rate when you're talking about balls and strikes. And I think you could adjust the strike zone in a way that would actually make there be more hitting in the majors because I think there's way too many strikeouts right now. Right. And like I say, if it's instantaneous and it's accurate, it's like the what's it called, the Hawkeye in tennis. I think that's perfectly fine. Okay. If they can do that. I object to the instant replay theater that they have in football and in baseball, where the umpires have to go over to the dugout and put on the cans and listen to New York. It should happen in 10 or 15 seconds. It just is ridiculous how long it takes.
Eric, like I said, I might disagree a little, but to support your point, you know, I was just reading the other day for my journalism class I taught. I assigned a story by our Giants beat writer, our San Francisco Giants beat writer. After, remember the check swing that ended their series?
Yes. Yeah.
The Dodgers, mm-hmm. Like one of the worst calls, you know, that's like evident. That's like exhibit A for robot umps. And one of the players in the Giants said when they saw the umpire crew and they knew who was going to be three of the four guys that are maybe I know play were terrible, that they changed their philosophy because they knew they were going to have to be more aggressive. Because usually they're the most selective team. So they actually had to change their philosophy in an important playoff series because of these bad umpires. So, you know, that argues against my point, but, you know, that really supports what you're saying.
But can I just say the check swing call is the stupidest thing in all of baseball. I would never appeal to an umpire 90 feet away or 110 feet away when it's literally right in front of my face and it's a judgment call anyways. It's the worst thing that happens.
Well, but how do you make that judgment, though, John? Do you say, did the bat cross the front of the plate or?
Yeah, right. Isn't it just like this? Isn't it like how far your hands go?
And it's really nebulous the way the written rule is written. As if did he intend to swing? And that's a judgment call. So why make that guy 110 feet away have to make that call in such a high pressure situation? Just make it yourself. You're
that is what I like. I do like what the intent of the batter was. So if regardless of where the bat was he really intending to swing or did he sufficiently pull back 51 versus 49?
That's the rule. That's why it's written. People try and attribute that as like, oh, the bat head across or the wrist's breaking. It's not written down. It's it's nebulous. Can you tell us the coldest day of the year? We're talking about baseball for as long as we are. Come on, spring.
Jonathan Greenberg, thanks for joining us. He is the lead columnist for Chicago's Athletic Coverage and the Athletic's founding editor. Hey, thanks for helping us out today.
Hey, anytime. This was really fun. I enjoyed it.
See you guys.
I did too. Thanks, John.
See you, man.
There, John.
Now, time for campaign 2022. Let's talk about the governor's race. Billionaire Ken Griffin still has not officially financially backed Aurora Mayor Richard Irvin for governor. At least four others have given $250,000 or more to Irvin's campaign. Why is Griffin waiting, guys? Is he having second thoughts, Lisa, or is he just naturally holding a little bit, but eventually he's going to throw his tens of millions of dollars into Irvin's campaign?
I mean, he signaled that he's excited about it. I don't know that he needs to sort of sock a ton of money into it right now or right this moment. When did Irvin just announce?
He announced on King Day.
So, I mean, he just announced and people are sort of not paying attention. I think Griffin can kind of wait until people are. But in a month or two, or a month, if there's no money coming his way, then it'll be curious to see if Griffin, you know, we'll have to ask, are you not going to back him? And if no, that may be a serious challenge come the fall election when whoever squares off with Pritzker.
Well, there is money coming his way. He is getting donations, but
the big money is going to be from Griffin. And Griffin has signaled that he's excited. He said in a statement, right, I'm excited about Irvin entering the race.
Well, Irvin has been able to go on the air, I guess. I'm certainly seeing his ads on YouTube with his first set of ads. One of them, he claims that he called out the National Guard in order to block riots in the wake of the George Floyd protests. And, of course, that is a lie. A mayor can't call out the National Guard. But
you can call out for the National Guard and they show up, but it wasn't because you called out.
By that token, I could call out the National Guard.
Yes,
so,
the governor has to do it.
And Jesse Sullivan's new ad also has a crime fighting message. He says that Pritzker's leftist agenda is literally killing us. He wants to defend the police, not defund them, and take the cuffs off our cops and put them back on criminals. That's Jesse Sullivan. So it's very clear that the tough on crime message is going to be what the gubernatorial candidates in the Republican Party are going to be going for, even though the governor doesn't have a whole lot to do with crime fighting. Irvin promises to prosecute criminals. Well, he's not running for state's attorney. He's attorney general. He's running for governor. But it's very clear that this issue is one that Republicans think is really going to resonate in Illinois. And I'm not so sure they're wrong.
I don't think so either. Yeah, I think that they're probably right.
Sullivan says on his campaign page, I actually asked him about it today. He said not only would he call out the National Guard more often, he would actually activate them to go after violent criminals. He wants the National Guard to, I guess, go on the South and West Side and track down these bad guys. This is his idea.
They don't have the authority to do that, though. They're not law enforcement. They're called in sort of to kind of stand guard. Then they're all going to have to go through the academy. That was sort of the big deal, too, when there was some unrest, two summers ago. Calling the National Guard. They're not trained to do that. And you start sort of having police officers, these layers of law enforcement together, that also makes it dangerous for them. We can all say, well, the governor has nothing to do with fighting crime, but he is a Chicago resident and things are bad here. It behooves him at some level as an elected leader to sort of push through, have some kind of policy that makes things safer for all.
Well, I think as far as Pritzker goes when it comes to handling violence, I'm not really sure what he can do aside from what he has. He's already allocated $300 million to anti-violence groups and anti-violence work, and he's committed resources to certain police departments during certain times. Maybe he needs to just commit more, but I think it's tough to hold a governor's feet to the fire on local crime. in a sense. Even though he is in Chicago, I believe his record on this has gone as far as he actually can as a governor without stepping on Lightfoot's toes or stepping on the toes of some of these other mayors. At some point, you got to look at the people who are locally involved and say, hey, you got to handle this. And that's what I feel like Pritzker's done at this point. So it's going to be – crime is definitely on everyone's mind right now, but I feel like Pritzker's going to be able to handle the message pretty well because he's actually made the financial commitments, at least, to say he's been handling this.
He doesn't mind stepping on the mayor's toes here, at least.
That's what, I mean, yeah.
He shows up for press conferences about these initiatives, as does Tony Preckwinkle.
Yeah.
You know, they show up for these press conferences and they're sort of like, this is what we're doing to fight crime. So he can't talk out of both sides of his mouth.
Doesn't hurt for a governor or even a gubernatorial candidate to acknowledge that crime is an issue. And we as a state have to do something about this. Mm-hmm. But I know members of the National Guard, and God bless them, they're good people who have careers that aren't police officers. So the idea that my friend who's a doctor, he's a surgeon, is going to now chase down some bad guys with his gun is dumb. That's just not a good police tactic.
I want to call it the National Guard to shovel the sidewalk in front of my house and fix my pothole. That's what I'm going to call them out for.
You know, the other funny thing to me about Richard Ervin is that it almost seems to me, Lisa, like he is waiting for Ken Griffin to write some checks because he has announced his candidacy and really isn't doing a full-on media tour. You know, at least Sullivan is out there. He'll come on my show. He'll talk to you guys. But Ervin has been sort of laid back right now, which is just strange to me.
Definitely a tactic. I mean, it's sort of have all the messaging done via press release. Isn't this how Governor Pritzker announced that he was running? I believe it was a YouTube video. First time around. I mean, a lot of folks are doing it. So
would you announce and wait 8 days before you did an interview, though? I mean, it would just seem to me like he should be on everybody's shows right now. He should be maybe because I want him on my show. But doesn't that make sense that he'd be more available, more visible?
Yes, it absolutely does. I agree with you 100%. I'm just saying that it is a tactic. If you are the PR person for somebody who may not be comfortable doing that, you may just sort of ease into it.
And the thing is, Lisa, Richard Ervin is very good. He's a very good speaker. He's very comfortable in front of crowds. This is not somebody they just, you know, pulled out of Costco to use.
Listen, everybody knows if you are nerdy or whatever, and you read the AP day book every day, that's the list of all of the things that happened for the day. As soon as he got elected, all of his events were public. All of them. The conversations I'm having with people, like, sort of, why is he not out and about? Everything that he did has been doing as mayor has been sort of like inviting the press. He's very savvy about making sure that we're all sort of clued in, but he's very savvy. He's very, very
savvy.
He's
also being very careful.
I'm not saying that.
And I'm very careful.
It's one thing to run for mayor. It's another thing to run for statewide office. And if you don't feel comfortable.
And of course, the other thing is that Griffin doesn't answer questions either. That you've got this guy who
I have
one big question for him is, if he doesn't like Illinois so much, if he doesn't like J.B. Pritzker, he's got more than enough money to move anywhere. Mm-hmm. It's like, why was he spending tens of millions of dollars to replace the governor when you're going to have a Democratic legislature anyway?
Hold on, Eric. That's wrong to think that.
I don't.
Because people would say that, you know, Trump people would say, if you don't like it, go move somewhere else. It was wrong then. It's not good to say that.
I mean, I like that at least he's putting his money where his mouth is. He is trying to elect what he thinks is a best government for the state of Illinois. Right, Eric?
Well, I don't know why he cares so much about having the best government for the state of Illinois. He could move to Gary, Indiana and commute. I'm talking about when you're talking about the kind of money that he's spending to change governors. I just don't.
He likes the state. He loves the influence. He likes the power.
He likes the power. He's able to sort of control the levers without having to run for office. He put all that money behind killing the fair tax
initiative.
Yes, he feels powerful that way. And honestly, what was that, the economic club that he spoke at, and talking about how now two of his employees have been attacked downtown?
Yeah,
I mean, it came across. It's the first time I've sort of seen him. He's pretty sort of down to business, talking about money. There you sort of heard a voice crack. This is my team. They've gotten attacked downtown. I know of people. We had somebody who was attacked at the end of our block. I mean, it went from sort of, okay, everybody's catalytic converters are gone, to sort of like, okay, now we have people jumping each other at the end of the block. And this is, it's somebody I know. We've had some issues before that. But I mean, I feel like we're back in the 90s again. To speak up about it, you can't really fault him for saying
this. Right, but why isn't he then getting involved in, say, the Chicago mayoral race? Because this is where, I mean, you've got all this crime, and it seems to be
because
really
she's not a millionaire. I think this is the battle of the millionaires. People make a joke about those headlines, but these are two rich guys kind of going up against each other. Well, him going up against Pritzker. I don't think Pritzker's looking for a fight from Ken Griffin.
I agree with whoever it was who said earlier that nerds like us are paying attention to this right now, but that most of the people in the public are just not really dialed into the governor's race yet, and they don't care if Richard Urban is taking questions.
The Omicron rates are going down. The CPS dashboard, though, sure lit up this week, didn't it? So how transparent are the Chicago public schools about what the infection rate is and where? And a parent who's a bioengineer noticed that the metrics had sort of changed. And then he compared it to his own system that he'd created. Who knew? But there was some smart guy out there tracking it on his own. They called CPS out on it. Then the Chicago public schools are sort of behind the eight ball on this thing, saying, well, it's not that we aren't being transparent. It's that we're trying to protect the privacy of people who get COVID, and also they want it to be more accurate.
John, what you brought up about them worried about confidentiality and all that, that was my immediate red flag. If you're not naming people, then it's not an issue. Like, everyone has the right to know if someone in their workspace, where they go to school, has COVID-19. That's just the way we're doing this. So to omit that information out of privacy concerns makes zero sense at all. They're not naming names from what I've read so far.
Yeah,
if they're doing process of elimination and saying, a teacher in this classroom on the second floor, all right, then it becomes a little bit of a problem. But if you're just saying, hey, you know, somebody in the building has COVID-19 or in this classroom, that's fine. At the place where I work, someone got COVID-19. We notify the whole company. Someone's got COVID-19. You handle it. No one feels like their privacy is violated. No one's outing anybody. Just the way we have to do this in this COVID era. It's frustrating, but just the way it is. So to use that as an excuse, it's not an excuse at all.
I don't think there's a lot of shame in that anymore anyway. If people connected the dots and they said, I think Joe has COVID, that's why he's not here or whatever, I don't think we would slam that person the way maybe at some point in the last 2 years we would have.
Don't you kind of operate as if other people around you have it, especially with Omicron?
Yeah.
I mean, when you're talking about the rates and the spread of which it's been happening, I'd say for the last month, I've just assumed that I'm interacting with people that have COVID. It's why I wear a mask for the most part, especially when I'm indoors. And there's no contact tracing anymore, you know, and the CDC doesn't recommend any sort of, staying away or isolation if you're vaccinated and boosted and you come in contact with someone with COVID. The rules have changed so much that I do see people being like, I don't see what the point is anymore of alerting everyone that one person you might have run into had COVID.
If you have a kid in a school, you're finding out long after the fact. Aren't they now reporting when cases are closed?
Yes, that's the
thing.
I mean,
that's ridiculous. You're going from sort of giving somebody some kind of like live time, like, okay, this person has tested positive, and revealing that versus now going to sort of like, case closed. You know, I don't know if that was 10 days ago or 15 days ago. It makes no sense. You know, I just read a story. I'm not sure who had it. Maybe it was Chicago Tonight, about how all these folks are sort of out of sick days and sick time, and they're trying to sort of figure out how to navigate all of this stuff, you know, quarantining and everything. So this just sort of adds to the stress. Like, okay, am I sick? Should I pull this kid out of school so that he's not exposed?
Do you know someone who has been vaccinated and boosted who has since gotten COVID?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, me too. I mean, all of us do, right? In my family, for that matter. Vaxxed, recently boosted, like around Christmas time or a little before, and with COVID. And that's just that way it is right now.
How are your family members doing, John?
My senior citizen parents both came down with COVID last week.
Oh.
94 and 88 years old.
Oh.
And they're doing okay. Dad says, I got a cold. Go, yeah, you tested positive. Mom says, I'm fine. And says, well, you seem to be fine, Mom, and that's a miracle because you shouldn't be. Looks like, knock on wood, they're going to get through it. You know, we're past that window of the worst that's of good. The symptoms, but not everybody, good Lord, is so fortunate as that. Maybe in terms of public disclosure, Blandon, they should just announce the names of the people who don't have COVID. The list would be shorter. One last thing, you guys. So Netflix is raising its rates, right? John, isn't it going from $10 to $15 a month, depending on the program that you get, right?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Or $16 maybe, $15.99 maybe. Yeah.
Right, yeah. We had a conversation on the radio this week about do you share your password. That is as illegal as file sharing for songs was 10 years ago. You're not supposed to do that. To date, Netflix has not once pushed a case on that because they know it's happening and they don't want backlash, even though the courts have said they have rights to do that. It's intellectual property. It's theft. You can't share your password. Not even the movies, however you might do that. You can't share your password outside of your household.
I don't know if I've shared my password, but let's say incidentally, I've entered my password on another TV and accidentally hit the save the password on that TV.
Yeah.
And then done it somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going down, man. But you know, with all those other streamers out there, they're loath to give people any more reason to jump off the platform. As great as Netflix is, the prices are going up. And if they start prosecuting people for sharing passwords, then maybe I'll just go be a HBO Max guy or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know about the price hike, but if you share like within your family, not everyone in your family lives in the same house, let's say theoretically, and then Netflix cracks down on that, and they do have a way of cracking down on this that I know they have considered, which is that they would make you change your password every month or so, like we have to do or had to do at the Tribune. You have to change your password every so often, so that if anyone happened to get a hold of your password, that it would be impossible for them to get into your account. And if you make it really difficult to share a password, so that like in John Hansen's case, theoretically, if he had theoretically logged in somewhere and left his sign on the TV, that would expire after a month, and then the person who had that on their TV would have to call John, and he would say, well, theoretically, my new password is this. but they don't do that. And I think the reason is that you know, it's, what is it, $16 a month now? And you think, well, that's okay, given that, you know, my kids and I get about five or six different people watching. That's fine. That's a good price. But if they were to make it so that you could only watch it in one house for that much, I think people would say, you know what?
Well, that
I'm
is.
Look for a, and that I'm going to look for a better deal.
Those are the terms of the agreement that it's in.
I know. If they were to enforce it,
it would be a mass revolt.
Don't you think we all have pods where people, I'm the Hulu guy, I pay for, and my buddy is the Netflix guy.
Absolutely.
And my other buddy is the HBO Max guy. So I think at the end of the day, all these companies are getting about as much revenue as they're going to get out of this. And if they start raising things incredibly, like to Eric's point, people, and they start enforcing it to that point, people are going to drop out. So I think it's within all their interests, even though they're all competitors, mm-hmm. knowing that everyone is in streaming pods.
I'm the Netflix guy. You know, I have tons of people mooching off of my Netflix.
Yeah.
And from my family, I'm the Disney Plus guy. You know, my niece and nephew are 5
really?
And 7 years old.
Listen to
they
this.
Watch my Disney Plus is full of cartoons.
Who's your HBO Max guy? Does he have room for one more?
This is a den of criminality. I didn't realize it was this rampant.
We're speaking theoretically here only. Yes. Theoretically.
I that's too lowbrow for me. I just sit around reading Shakespeare.
There you go. These companies aren't losing money off of this, though.
Lord, that is not so not the point. That is not the point.
Are you, John?
Do you go into a drugstore and go, Walgreens has enough money, I'm going to take a candy bar. They're not going to miss it.
Sometimes. No,
no. Only if I go to CVS and do it for a different product so it evens out. That's what we're trying to say, John.
But you guys have touched on something that is the equivalent of what was described previously as refrigerator rights. You know a good friend when they can go into your house, they open up the refrigerator without having to ask. That's refrigerator rights. It's a level of friendship. This is, what did you call it, Hanson? Pod rights or something.
Streaming pod, yeah.
Yeah. So that happens out there. And while we are not endorsing it, the Mincing Rascals officially recognize that as an interesting phenomenon that we're...
Well, John, I don't believe you've told us about your theoretical membership in streaming pods. Are we out of time?
I have nothing else to say about this. We are out of time. Eric Zorn and John Hansen, Lisa Donovan, Brandon Pope, nice to hear you all. We are produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and before I say we'll drop another pod on you next week, just in case you're listening to these very words, remember, you can also tell your friends to listen to WGN Radio Saturday nights at 8 o'clock. A version of this is now broadcast from 8 to 9 on WGN Radio. Okay, guys, thanks. We'll visit with you next week. So long.
Thanks, everybody. Bye. Bye. Thanks.
All right, see you.
Well, I got some editing to do, but I'll figure it out.
I'll see you.
I'll see you. Thanks,
see you.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.